Hi, all. These are generally conversations between adults after the children have left the table. The language can be spicy and the subjects can get saucy. So if you're ready, this is the Southern Fork. Unscripted kitchen chats and also studio chats with some of the most interesting voices in the culinary South. I'm Stephanie Burt, a food and beverage writer based in Charleston, South Carolina, who travels with her fork to write for a variety of publications, from magazines you might have on your coffee table to the website you love to visit for your favorite recipes. And I'm inviting you to come behind the scenes with me to get to know the people who make this Southern culinary landscape so special. I'm always hungry for the next bite, thirsty for that next sip, and ready for the next conversation. Let's dig in. The Southern Fork is honored to be presented again this year by Townsend Automotive in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. For more than 48 years, the Townsend family of dealerships has been a locally owned company built on service and connection with its customers. And their experienced team can walk you through the car buying process side by side from test drive to service oil changes and beyond. Townsend goes through a rigorous vetting process to make sure that every pre-owned vehicle adheres to quality standards. And right now, there's plenty on the lot to choose from in various makes and models. Visit TownsendHonda.com for current inventory, or if you're in West Alabama, stop in. Townsend Automotive salutes local entrepreneurs, from restaurateurs to podcasters, and they welcome you to be part of a community that does the same. There is some delicious restaurant cooking happening in Charlotte, North Carolina. And when I talk to many of the chefs responsible for it, more often than not, they point to FreshList as one of their day-to-day partners making that possible. CEO Jesse Ledbetter was in sports licensing when he started growing his own food, and it opened his eyes to the supply chain issues connecting Carolina farms to Carolina restaurants. So he decided to build that connection. FreshList is a food hub, and it started in 2014 to shift food production back to small-scale family farmers. Jesse and his team, including Director of Operations and Farm Coordinator Aaron Bradley, connect both home cooks and professional chefs to the products of more than 200 local farmers. Cooks simply use an app to order fruits and vegetables from a variety of local farms, and then FreshList delivers. In short, they've built a virtual farmers market, and they're part of a growing number of food hubs in the country doing just that. But what happens at FreshList and at other food hubs isn't just about getting the right cantaloupe to the right chef. It's about building community and strengthening it one fruit and vegetable at a time. Welcome to the Southern Fork, you two.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you, it's a good day when I land at a warehouse full of veggies and walk-ins. You know I'm always home when I roll up and I'm like, gravel parking lot, large coolers full of turnips. Thanks for having me in here today at FreshList.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Yeah. Well, I have lots of questions and I want to get started in this. Jesse, I'm going to really start with you. I think Southern Fork listeners know by now that I'm very interested in local food systems. And what that means is eating from the place where you are, whether that's on vacation or on a weekly basis at your home address. So what inspired you to kind of bring all of this to life?
Money.
It's so freaking lucrative,
yeah.
Right?
I was working in corporate sports licensing and I was like, you know where I could make more money? Ironically enough, so a couple blocks from this warehouse filled with produce, I bought a house in 2009, and with some friends and my partner, we decided to buy an empty lot that was overrun with kudzu and turn it into a little urban farm. And just started throwing seeds in the ground and getting back to the farming roots my grandparents had. I remember calling my grandma and asking, like, how do I can tomatoes? And she was like, why are you trying to do that? You went to college and you didn't want to have anything to do with it. And but it really just...
And you were like, I feel that this is going to be the ticket. People need canned tomatoes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted... I always say, like, I just imagined waking up and being, you know, 75 years old and asking myself, like, what did you do with your time and your life? And
it's a great talents? Question to be, though.
Yeah. And I just wanted a better answer. Mm-hmm. So started going and talking to farms and trying to... Really, I didn't have a solution when I went in to starting Freshless. It was just trying to understand how it worked. Mm-hmm. Chefs and farmers were the initial model. Like, how do we connect them better? Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's why I kickstarted it.
Yeah. And what about you? What brought you into this wonderful, really slick warehouse life?
So I grew up in a community, like a tobacco community north of Raleigh called Creedmoor. Creedmoor is known for two things in the world, and it is mules and it is moonshine. And sadly, both of those things are dying away now. And they were a really big tobacco grower. And so my family was not farms. My parents bought land right before I was born. And I wanted a really fun summer job one summer. And I was like, I'm going to go work on this farm. And they have pick your own. And I'm going to sell strawberries. And my mom's like, you're going to quit at the end of the day because you're going to be hot and your shoes are going to get dirty and you're just going to quit. And I was like, cool, fun fact, bet. 10 years later, I'm still doing this, for better or for worse. I really loved my experience working on a family farm. The farm that I worked on has been in continuous family-owned operation since 1861.
Awesome.
And so when I graduated from App and I came down to Charlotte to teach, I quickly realized that teachers don't make any money in this state and that I needed a second job. And so I had run roadside stands in Raleigh, and I had helped Raleigh kind of craft their roadside stands zoning ordinances because they didn't have any at the time. And so then I came here, and I started working roadside stands here. And when I quit teaching, I was looking for my next opportunity. And luckily enough for me, my father-in-law had the office next door to Jesse at the co-working space up the street. And he poked his head in one day and asked Jesse how Freshless is going. Two of them have known each other for a long time because he's done a lot of work in this neighborhood. And Jesse's like, I think I'm ready to hire somebody. And Doug's like, have you met my daughter? And so it's very fortuitous. Actually, the building that we're sitting in is one that, you know, he's helped us get into. So it's been fun.
So food systems sound really dry. And I'm a food writer. This is where the podcast comes out of, and selling food writing about food systems is a hard sell. But in reality, I find it really exciting because it's the thing that impacts us the most. When all of these supply chains and people couldn't get toilet paper and all this stuff with COVID and all this stuff happened. And even now, like I was at Target on Sunday and there wasn't any Puffs, you know, Kleenex, like... You know,
it is allergy season.
It's hard.
Yeah. You got to know your local Kleenex farmer.
Yeah. I don't. Can you hook me up with a local Puffs farmer? Anyway, that's very hilarious, and I'm going to try to ignore it so we can continue this interview. But those things are the things that people talk about all the time, gas prices and supply chain things, right? And so when you're starting to see that space between – how do we get local farms working with local chefs? Why did you think that was important? Just from a, like a consumer growing his own tomatoes standpoint.
I think chefs are probably one of the most important consumers, stakeholders, influencers of local food simply because they're the ones who can adapt that menu based on what the farm has. And I'm talking about the chefs of, you know, the good restaurants, mm-hmm. No offense to P.F. Chang's, but they're not going to change a menu set.
We really focus on independent restaurants here at the Southern Fork. So, so we're speaking the same language. So. Yeah. Sorry, P.F. Chang's.
I'd gone to some of these restaurants and I would see these chefs and like the pride they took in, you know, even as simple as putting a farm name on a chalkboard or mm-hmm. some of the easy stuff that they used to do in the early farm to table movement. But then, you know, seeing those same chefs at the farmers markets on Saturday and be like, oh, wow, these guys really take this seriously. I think that's what really kind of sparked that for me. You know, they're kind of farmers by proxy because they're whatever they're buying in theory is what the farmers want to be planting. Mm-hmm. And they have a lot of power there.
Yeah. And influence, you know, I didn't know what Chipotle was before Rick Bayless started cooking with it. And I started watching Rick Bayless cook with it. And now it's in my kitchen. So Aaron, what is an ingredient? What's a foodstuff that you feel a farmer is now growing in the Charlotte Piedmont region they weren't growing before Freshlist got involved?
No pressure.
Yeah, seriously though. Probably just the sheer amount of different varieties of like something as simple as edible flowers that we have now. Like when I first started at Freshlist, like one of the, like our like three wholesale deliveries that we did in our own name was to Haberdish because Colleen Hughes wanted to use edible flowers in her cocktails. And just she was ordering them like off of Amazon or something. And Jesse's like, you do know that I can get you those, right? And so we have
it was the ice ball.
Yes, it was the roses and the ice balls. Mm-hmm. And so now all of the roses and the ice balls at Haberdish in season come from a farm that's 5 miles away from Haberdish. And all of Colleen's restaurants are using local flowers, and they're the single largest purchaser of edible flowers that we have. And they're keeping these farms in business by buying these and committing to them year round. And so we started out basically just saying, oh, we're going to throw a mix. We'll have a mix of things together. And now we're starting to separate them out. So we have borage now, and we have nasturtiums now, and we have violas now. And you know, we've gotten as granular on occasions of doing, do you just want the blue ones? I can get you just the blue ones. Do you just want the pink ones? I can get you just the pink ones. And being able to take something that requires, you know, not a lot of care and comes back on its own, and being able to really have regenerative income every single week for the farms that we work with. Those are crops that don't necessarily have a ton of input into them. Mm-hmm. You know, being able to use seconds, being able to use, you know, we're in rob season right now. So like all the collard plants and the kale plants and the brassicas that have produced all winter long are bolting. So we're selling the bolts this week so that those cocktail programs are going to use the flowers, which is the last little bit that that plant's going to produce before it has to be pulled out of the ground.
So it's a minimal waste.
Exactly.
Kind of situation as well. And, you know, you can use chive flour when it goes to flour instead of just chives. So these are things that your grandmother, Jesse, knew, and we've kind of lost that in this middle post-war time. How many years has Freshlist been around?
So we started technically in 2014, but we started off as a food tech company. Mm-hmm. We had, you know, grand visions of solving all the problems in local food with mm-hmm. a fancy app and not having to actually get our hands dirty. Spoiler alert, it's not that easy. We started the hub. You know, we kind of became an accidental food hub because the technology didn't work, but we had gotten to know farmers and chefs, and I felt like I'd made promises to farmers that I was going to find a way to make what they were doing more viable, profitable, whatever. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't ready to give up. And we said, well, why don't we start distributing and actually, you know, learn firsthand how this whole thing works. That's when Aaron came on, and Matt and Gigi shortly thereafter. 2018, 2019 were, you know, our first full years in operation. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you get the curveball, the pandemic, you know, all the things that I felt like we had been working for and the people that I knew that were local food champions had been like screaming at the top of our lungs for so long. All of a sudden people were like, oh yeah, we should pay attention to where our food's coming from because those grocery store shelves, we just don't know when they're going to be empty and when they're going to have stuff.
So, yeah. It's actually easy. I have community supported grocery in Charleston, and that's the retail version of what you do. And you do retail and wholesale to restaurants, and it just shows up at my door, and they basically curate my fridge. It's amazing. And then I can add on with my wonderful login and add on all kinds of cheese and meat and whatever. So It just sucks you in little by little, but it also sucks you in with flavor. I'm a big proponent of, we are not trying to be holier or more fancy. We are trying to eat better tasting food that is better for us. I wonder if you could attempt to answer, and this probably would be an essay assignment if I was still teaching at UNC Charlotte, which thank God I'm not, because those students got a lot of this every day. What makes it so difficult for restaurants to use local food? You're in such a big market here in Charlotte. I want to know what some of the challenges have been.
It's the consumers. I think it's that if you asked any chef, even the P.F. Chang chef that's not listening, if they would rather cook with fresh, local, whatever, you know, whatever is around and available, agnostic of cost and how consistent, of course they would want to do those things. But we got to a point where we didn't value food as much as, you know, other countries. I enjoy traveling. One of the things I enjoy and one of the things I recognize, we usually always try and do some sort of food tour or cooking class and go to markets and, like, you know, see what they have at the market in Chiang Mai and Thailand. And food is still so much, I just feel like it's valued so much more. And as a result, it probably tastes better overall. But somewhere along the way, maybe in the 70s, 80s, you know, never the whole get big or get out farming movement happened and we turned it into manufacturing, that changed things and people just like went cheap. Mm-hmm. And so consumers, even, you know, myself included, sometimes I'll get sticker shock on something. Yeah. And they're like, man, but that's because I grew up eating, you know, McDonald's and
yeah, me too.
Cheap food.
Yeah.
And again, I don't think we're not going to solve local food systems in my lifetime, maybe Aaron's lifetime.
Maybe Bennett's lifetime. That's the goal. Yeah. We're solving it by the time that my 11-week-old is.
So I think for us, it's just about steering that ship in a little bit better direction. Mm-hmm. And the chefs, there are so many, you know, the chefs that we have in this city. I mean, I love Charleston. I love going down there to visit. I love going down there to eat. Charlotte's like developed its own identity and it continues to evolve. But the farmers here are also incredibly talented. I think a lot of what our role is trying to help them understand other things they could grow. Like, we're creating markets for those things because I think you'll naturally have more biodiversity and healthier land whenever those things happen.
Yay. So what's so fun about improving your food system, improving your own eating system, is number one, it's personal. So you can improve it in one choice. And you have multiple choices per day because we're humans and we have to eat. Number two, it gets more delicious pretty immediately if you choose to even add 10%. I always say, really, eating local is about 10%. Like, I add avocado toast. That did not come from the Charlotte area today. It came from, you know, Mexico. But I don't make a strict rule. You mentioned something that I wonder is an American thing or a Western thing. And this is really that we value productivity more than anything. And so you said farming is not manufacturing. Why is it not manufacturing? Why can't we make it manufacturing?
Weather.
Yeah, nature.
Inputs. You can't control, like, it was 40 degrees last night. You can't control that. Like, if you're making, you know, Ford Tauruses, you know exactly what all of your inputs are in a Ford Taurus. And you know from start to finish how long it's going to take somebody to build, you know, or some robot these days to build that car. And you know up until 2020 exactly what your input costs are going to be. Farming is not that way. You know, we have the caveat every week on our list that something may not come in. And if when we start working with a new chef, we are very honest. If we have everything that you order every single week, that we're doing this incorrectly. Because sometimes, you know, it's hot and sometimes it's cold and sometimes it just rains too much. And
sometimes it doesn't rain enough.
And sometimes it doesn't rain enough. And our farmers have a lot of pride in the product that they bring us every single week. And they're not going to bring us something that they don't feel comfortable and confident in. So thusly, our chefs are not going to get something that their farmer does not believe is quality, because agriculture is so much based in relationships, it can't be commodified. At least fruit and vegetable agriculture is hard to commodify in the ways that we have been forced to commodify it post-World War II. Now, you know, with soybeans and with feed corn, that is a whole different ballgame that we don't get into.
Well, that's been modified to the point of unrecognizable pre-World War II seeds.
And so it makes it to where every time when you get a fresh list order, it might look a little different. And that's the way that it should. Every week, the green garlic should get bigger. You know, every week, the strawberries should get a little sweeter. And that's the way that food was created to be.
And to clarify, your relationships that you're talking about aren't just personal relationships. They're actually relationships with soil, water, land, weather, animals, insects, all that stuff, right?
It's very difficult. We exist as food hubs at this painful intersection of nature, which doesn't have to be painful, but how the rest of the world and, you know, society wants things to be. Mm-hmm. I had a friend the other day, Tim, if you're listening, I apologize, I'm bringing you up, but we do a little bit of home delivery business, and our orders are due at 10 a.m. on Tuesday for delivery on Friday for Tim. Very similar to Amazon, same day thing, just with a couple extra days mixed in. And he started giving me a hard time. He's like, I always forget to put my order in. Because it's like, Tim, you can yell at me all you want, but it's the land and the farmers, you know, like this, your expectations need to be reset about how things should be. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the things that happened with me whenever we were just throwing seeds in the ground and I was planting the wrong kinds of trees because I didn't have enough farmers to reach out to whenever I was starting our little garden. Essentially, just, you know, you have all these painful these painful steps along the way where you have no idea how things really work. And as you start to learn that and you're like, okay, I did finally get some good tomatoes off these plants, it kind of resets your personal economy a little bit to where mm-hmm. the things you value. And, you know, we don't really do gifts for friends around Christmas. We do a big friends plated dinner, you know, get fancy, but it's all, you know, here's where everything came from. And mm-hmm. it's great. You know, some of my friends get it. Not all of them are customers. It's fine. I don't expect that. But you can see that it flips a switch with some people. And I don't know. That's the enjoyable part for me.
Yeah. Well, I think we can talk about how difficult it is, but we can also talk about how fun the serendipitous nature of it is. I am a better cook than I was before I started really focusing and being mindful on local food. And I really believe now, after writing and being in restaurants for 15 years, that sourcing and sourcing well mixed with technique are the two reasons why a restaurant or a chef or another kind of creative culinary professional is what they are.
Well, and it's really fun because, like, when you deliver to a restaurant, it's always nice because the executive chef knows what's coming, or the chef de cuisine knows what is coming, but the sous chefs don't know and the line cooks don't know. So you get to come in and it's like being Santa Claus every single week because they want to know what chef ordered. Mm-hmm. And you walk them through what it is and you explain to them what it is. And it's a chance for you to get to appreciate, but it's also such a learning opportunity for them every week because, you know, a lot of them are very young and they're coming into this industry and they're learning about all of these new types of fruits and vegetables that they may not have been exposed to with as they're younger.
And maybe a region that they're not familiar
exactly.
with.
Because so many of our young cooks come to Charlotte because of Johnson & Wales, and Johnson & Wales pulls from all over. So you have a lot of, you know, kids who've come down here from the Northeast learning how to cook in the South. Mm-hmm. And it's been fun as we've been on this journey with Fresh List because a lot of those, you know, junior sous are now to the point in their careers where they're starting to run kitchens. And so it's nice to see them as like, oh, like you were here and now you've got your own place and now you brought us with you. That's how our business has been able to expand the way it has, is because we've kept our original customers and we have grown up with, you know, those junior sous and now into their mm-hmm. executive roles.
To your point, I probably overcooked some steaks that I got from, you know, who knows, Walmart, Food Lion, Whole Foods, whatever, when I was younger. Didn't feel that bad about it. But if I overcook a steak that I got from, you know, Crin's Ranch or First Hand Foods, I can feel them crying while I'm overcooking that steak.
It's amazing how respect shifts and how the meal shifts when you feel that you're not the only person in the room. When you're cooking and you know First Hand Foods, it feels like that person is with you. So you're cooking from a place of community. Anytime that strawberry gets sweeter, mm-hmm. like you're saying, that green garlic gets a little bigger, until you experience that, it's hard to explain. And yeah. it sounds real woo-woo, and maybe it is woo-woo. Maybe that's part of our physiological thing. But we could talk all day about this stuff, and this is many more conversations down the line. But I do have to start to roll into these final questions. And since there's two of you, I want you to kind of play off each other, and then we'll work together. So I want to know, since you got so sucked in with roadside stands, which is a really specific thing to get sucked into. It's hot, dry, sad, sometimes boring work, sometimes frustrating work, but also really satisfying. What's making you hungry now? I mean, you have an 11-week-old baby. You're coming back into this business. Maternity leave. I mean, you're here. You're ready. You've had a break.
Oh, yeah. No, he had to basically kick me out of here. And then I would be like, hey, like, do you guys need anything? Like, I can come. I can just do some computer things. Like, I can do a little bit. Like, once she got to the point where I had figured her out a little bit. But I think it's the people that I work with. And, like, it's the people in this building. And then it's all the farmers that I get to sign checks for every week. And, you know, evolving with them and seeing them, watching their kids grow up. And knowing that the money that I'm sending to them every week is helping them raise their kids. And that's one of the things that I tell people when people ask me, like, why is it important to support local? I was like, well, you could, you know, buy a corporation owner a second or third home, or you could buy a guy up the road's kids' tap shoes. Like, you could put money back
into. That's
a
really good comment.
Is Cody Barbie?
I'm going to use that.
But it's kind of fortuitous because, like, one of our farmers passed down a lot of her daughter's clothes to me because she's like, I don't need anymore. If you take all of my things, then I won't have any more kids. And so now I'm, like, literally reaping what I've sown because I wrote them the checks to buy these clothes, and now my kid wears them every day. Thank you, Alicia, very, very much. I'm sure you'll listen to this. But it's the fact that I'm physically incapable of not being around people, to the point where COVID was really hard for me because I couldn't be around the people that I cared about. And really the only people I got to see every single week were my farmers. And the only people I got to talk to, you know, day in, day out were these people. And we've built this business with them. And COVID really just brought us all closer together because I'm really proud of the fact that I got to write them checks every week in 2020 when a lot of other people didn't get to write them checks. So
I feel like so many of our friends got, like, when COVID hit, it was like the longest spring break of their life. And they're, yeah. you know,
they're doing puzzles, making sourdough.
Yeah.
And I'm like, y'all, I don't work that way. Like, I actually said I wrote a piece for Bitter Southerner. And when I have a newsletter, and when it came out, I said, I don't make sourdough, so I just worked.
Yeah, that's kind of what we did.
I was like, because I was just like, I'm not made for sitting and doing puzzles. Like,
yeah. I sat in this office and hand entered lines and lines and lines of orders. We had a country club that we worked with that wanted to put together basically like a CSA for their members, like a grocery pickup. And we thought it'd be great. And we thought we were going to get like 15 orders and like 100 orders in. I'm like, I'm not a computer and I can't do this anymore. And like, the very first day we were here, I have a picture of Gigi sitting in a lawn chair with her computer on top of a red cooler, like 50-gallon cooler, because we didn't have any furniture yet because we had literally gotten the permits and the keys to this building the first week of March. We had to convince the building inspector to come out because he was like, oh, no. We're like, you don't understand. Like, I need this cooler turned on. Like, how badly I need this cooler turned on.
Like, again, my experience with COVID was very different than a lot of people's in that it was some of the most rewarding years so far of this journey, partially because, you know, we didn't have supply chain disruptions and all these things that we believe to be true were tested. Mm-hmm. Farmers, I think farmers are enough to keep me going, just broadly speaking, pretty much everything we do, our metric is, if we're going to think about something we should try or a new, you know, product or business to get into, whatever, is it good for the farmer? And knowing that no matter how early I was up during COVID, there was a farmer that had probably already, you know, been up for at least an hour.
Yeah.
And then consequently, chefs, no matter how late I stayed up, chefs were going to be up for another couple hours. And again, you're just around, you're in this community where farmers and chefs and those of us here, not obviously not doing it for profit. Mm-hmm. We want to make money. I deserve, you know, I think we all deserve to
have a
to
life.
Be compensated for that. Yeah. And I think that's the one thing farmers, I have plenty of fulfillment there, but the one thing that kind of started to change as our team grew was how much I wanted it for them. I wanted to create a place where people could find meaning and not have to spend 7 years working in NASCAR.
Hey, so. NASCAR has meaning sometimes.
Yeah, no, it's great. Great.
We're great at turning line cooks and juniors or in sous chefs into delivery drivers. Very good at it.
What's one aspect of your personality that really meshes with an aspect of this job that you've created for yourself?
Sadistic, I guess.
Compulsive.
No, I think problem solving, like ever since I was a kid, best thing I could hear is my mom or someone saying, you can't do that. I just always would like figure out how to prove them wrong. And, mm-hmm. you know, I didn't want to fail. Have since become comfortable with failure, as one does.
You know, I'm a freelance writer, so I have as well.
Right.
Also, I learned in public how to be an audio engineer, something I wouldn't suggest for anyone, nor should you go back and listen to episodes 50 and back. just let them lie where they are.
PC, pre-chopsticks.
Definitely pre-chopsticks.
Yeah, I think it's the problem that just questioning, I know it's one thing that probably drives a lot of the team crazy is again, hearing, oh, we can't fit that many strawberries onto the truck. And I'm like, can we though? it's, you know, from a personal standpoint in my own development, finding those boundaries and making sure you operate within them and improve, always be improving.
What is one thing keeping you up at night?
That I've forgotten something. Mm-hmm. I go to bed, at least pre-infant, very convinced that I had messed something up.
Oh, shit. She's still in the car?
Yeah. You told me this morning to bring her in, and I just completely forgot. No, she's at home with my husband. Please don't turn me into CPS. I think, that I've always forgotten something or I'm going to let somebody down. I added entirely too much asparagus to our asparagus order this week. And Matt's like, did you mean to have an extra 100 pounds of asparagus in the cooler? And I was like, yes, because I didn't want to ruin anyone's Easter brunch. Like, I'm always trying to find a way to make something better so that I don't have to short someone, that I don't, like, I have another option for something because I am terrified that it's going to be my fault that I missed something on the purchase order or I didn't list something or someone's going to, I'm just always terrified, oldest child syndrome, that someone's mad at me.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'm not going to jump in and be your therapist on that. I'm just going to let that lie. As an older sibling, I get you. I feel it, but
I mean, saw a meme the other day. It was like, do you have an anxiety disorder or are you just like the oldest female sibling? And I was like, yes, there
I
you go.
I saw that same meme. I was like, can I repost? Okay, so I have a magic picnic basket. And this is something that I reserve only for Southern Fort guests. I actually do not believe in the death penalty, although I love having the discussion over glass of Amaro at the end of the evening with the chef or another culinary professional about death row meals. So instead of death row meal, I want to bring you some things that bring you life. So I can time travel. I can go back in time and conscript anybody to make anything that you would just love one more taste of or love to try. I can cook a little bit and I can source for you really, really well because I just told you how important that is. So I'd love to bring you some of your favorite things. And since you work all the time together and we're sitting next to Bennett's pack and play, I feel like you're probably pretty close and we're just gonna have you make a picnic basket together. So what are a couple things each of you would like to have in that basket?
Birdsong's honey IPA, the double IPA, definitely.
Done.
Yeah, I think if we're putting beers in,
Wait, are we putting other stuff in besides beers?
It's you and I. No, we don't have to put anything in that's not beer. The Lenny Boy Citrophilia IPA, because Lenny Boy was the brewery that we worked at for the first year and a piece that I was at Fresh List. And I think we were there longer than Towns, the owner, had anticipated that we would be there. But it did involve us not only paying rent, but all four of us at the time having hefty bar tabs at the end of the week. And Lenny Boy was the place where we built Fresh List, and it was the place that I learned to love IPAs. So
I'm not even going to get like celebrity chef wise because I didn't really keep up enough. Like sometimes Matt, our, you know, in-house, one of our in-house chefs will talk about some chef, like I should know them by first name. And mm-hmm. I don't, you know, I'm out of that loop. I want, you know, Greg Collier here in Charlotte. I don't know how much you've kept up with the scene.
Pretty good. I'm eating there tomorrow night, and Greg and I have done an episode together.
Anything that he would spend my summers on the Mississippi, you know, fishing and catching these catfish, but then taking it to my grandma, who, God rest her soul, would, you know, basically just drop it in some hot oil and fry it. I'm sure there are better ways. You know, some of the dishes that I've had there at Lee and Louise are fantastic. Jamie Swafford, who's like chef and farmer. That's, I love seeing
husband of Kia Mastriani.
Yeah, one of her pies, and then something that Swafford cooks. Just one thing that we have, because we do have chefs that, you know, we're around chefs all the time, and there have been a couple that, you know, realize this is a great way to stay in the industry and close to it without having to do the 70, 80 hour a week grind. But it's so cool to see people who understand how the kitchen works start to see how farms work, and yeah, vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
I think anything I've had, he had some pozole at Free Soup Day on New Year's that was just phenomenal. And then I would probably have like some cheap turkey sandwich on white bread. Like I've actually had the last meal thought a lot. I don't know what that says about me. And it would be something like guilty. Like I wouldn't care about sustainability or anything at that point, you know, just turkey, American cheese, and a white Subway roll.
Nice. So one of my biggest regrets in life is that my grandmother never taught me her biscuit recipe, and I watched her make it 2 million times with white lily flour. And I can cut them the way that she can, but I do not know how to make them the way that she did. And my mom's are good, but they're not quite there. Same thing with her cornbread dressing. She makes a sage cornbread and white bread dressing that is my absolute favorite thing in the whole wide world. And when I got introduced into my in-laws, who I love more than life itself, they put Jimmy Dean sausage in it. And I was like, no, that does not belong in there. And so those two things could to tie to her. First kitchen that I was ever in, my dad's best friend, who passed away when I was in high school, owned an Italian restaurant in the thriving metropolis of Davenport, Iowa. And
is that where John Deere is based?
It is where, John Deere is based in Moline, Illinois, which is across the river.
Did
so,
you know that Maggiano's?
It is, yes, very similar to Maggiano's. It's but not. His also, heirs wish
some,
it was.
I need some points for knowing that.
It is. So I grew up whenever my parents would take me to
Hello.
Up there. There's very little to do in Davenport, Iowa with your elementary school children. And one of the things is to go to the John Deere Museum and let your children climb all over the combines all afternoon. So I would sit up in the top of these big, massive tractors and just, you know, dream of one day, you know, running something that large. And then we would go to Terry's restaurant, and he makes, like, it's lasagna, and it's Chicago-style pizza because you're there in the Midwest. And those meals, I've been back since he's passed away, but it's not the same. It's not the same as being able to go back there and put your own toppings on your pizza when you're 9 and, you know, having that pizza come back out to you.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that's good. And with some combine climbing.
Yeah. And when you wear yourself out climbing combines, and then your parents take you to get pizza and ice cream, because there's this ice cream chain there called Whitey's, and then they put you to bed full of sugar and Chicago-style pizza, and it's great. And then they drink too much cheap domestic beer. It's perfect.
My NASCAR days are coming back. It's like, this episode is sponsored by John Deere. Yeah. For all your lawn mowing.
John
and
Deere, call me. We can work something out. All right. If people want to learn more about Freshlist and all the work that is happening behind the scenes to make the Charlotte food taste so good when it lands to your plate, you can go to thesouthernfork.com. I'm going to have links there as well as images so you can see the faces behind the voice. If you like what you hear, there are more than 270-ish episodes in the archives. Remember, don't go past 50.
The Sarah Clough one's my favorite.
Well, and the Sarah Clough one's also in the 30s. So you need to listen to the Sarah Clough one and then skip forward to 50.
I'm sorry, my audio engineering was rough. But if you like what you hear, please subscribe. That's the easiest way to make sure that it comes to your podcast app of choice every time there is a new episode. New episodes drop Fridays, and it's Tuesday, and I'm here at Freshlist doing my thing. So thank you so much for spending time with me on a crazy week when asparagus and strawberries are coming in Charlotte, North Carolina. I appreciate it.
How many pounds would you like to take home?
I have a 2005 Kia, so however many pounds.
I can. You'd be amazed. My Honda Pilot fits exactly 2 grand worth of produce because I stacked to the brim one time with tomatoes to take to Lindsay Barrow, a community-supported grocery. I was at Bush and Vine, and Sam was like, Aaron, that's not all going to fit. And I was like, Sam, it's got to make it fit because I have to meet Lindsay in an hour and a half in Columbia. It's got to, like, we don't have another option here. You don't have a vehicle I can take. It's $2,000. I can make it fit.
That sounds great. Thanks a lot, y'all.
You've been listening to The Southern Fork. I can't wait to bring you more culinary conversations. But in the meantime, I have one question. Are you going to eat all that?